Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy. Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. I'm Helen McLean.
And I'm Jan McIntosh Brown.
So thanks for tuning in to this episode. The last episode that we put out, Jan and I were discussing a journal article all about the kind of markers of aspiration, protecting aspiration risk.
Pneumonia, you know, what sort of things you could, it had a matrix in it that helped sort of identify issues that could that are strongly linked to aspiration pneumonia. From memory.
Yeah, so we just thought we would do a bit of a kind of two-parter focusing around dysphagia because March, the week that we are recording this episode, in fact, the 11th to the 17th of March is Nutrition and Hydration Week here in the UK, and we thought it'd be nice to kind of keep the theme of discussing dysphagia going. We had planned to have a guest join us, another speech and language therapist who's been involved in the kind of rolling out of RCSLT's position paper on thickened fluids.
And RCSLT, for those not in the UK, is the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapists here in the UK.
Yeah, so we'd hoped that a speech therapy colleague would have been able to join us, but just as such as the life of speech and language therapy, as I'm sure across all aspects of the NHS, she's just being pulled in too many directions and hasn't been able to join us, unfortunately. But that means that you guys get to listen to Jan and I discussing all things dysphagia and brain injury in this episode. And what we thought we would talk a bit more specifically about was kind of swallowing safely after brain injury. We just thought we'd chat a bit more about kind of what we see and how we maybe kind of manage issues with eating and drinking safely after brain injury.
Because Helen and I, neither of us, or not now, Helen, for you, is it that you don't work in really acute? Yeah, so what we see is sort of after a person has, you know, got to a situation where they're medically stable and they're ready for rehab, although maybe your new service, they're kind of, you know, maybe still in that transition to being ready for rehab, or...
Yeah, I think, so what Jan's referring to there is that the service I work in Lanarkshire has, in the last 4 months or so, opened an inpatient unit for neuro rehab for patients with brain injury, so separate from, for example, stroke. So we are seeing, as a service, people at a much earlier stage and more intensively than we used to. The kind of number of patients that speech and language therapy are seeing who have some sort of change to their eating, drinking, swallowing skills has kind of increased recently. But it's very different to the sort of input that I would have had a few years ago when I worked in stroke or on a care of the elderly ward or dealing with individuals with progressive conditions, because every cause of injury to the brain that might lead to a swallowing difficulty can have its own presentation, can't it?
Yeah, when I think about the swallowing difficulties that I've supported in my time in inpatient rehab, I would say the majority of those difficulties would relate more to behavioural difficulties or cognitive difficulties. However, we do still have situations where people come in with more physiological swallowing difficulties. So an example that I was mentioning to Helen was a man who came in nil by mouth to our service. He had a peg, one of his rehab goals, and you know, we accepted that as a team, was for him to return to oral intake. So, you know, it was very much an impairment based swallowing program that we did. And so, you know, even although I'm saying, oh, it's all behavioral and cognitive, actually, you know, we have to be prepared to support people with whatever level of difficulty they come in with.
Yeah, and you saying that, it's just making me think of some people that I have seen in community over the years that, say, for example, they've had a tumour removed. And I'm thinking there's definitely been some people over the years who've had a particular type of tumour, or tumour, an acoustic neuroma. And in the course of having that surgery, there's been an impact on cranial nerves, mm-hmm. leading to facial weakness, leading to dysarthria and dysphagia at an oral preparation stage. So that's been the difficulty that the person has presented with from a physiological motor function point of view. But we are also seeing individuals who may have that but still have, for example, some cognitive deficits. So mm-hmm. their ability to potentially understand the rationale of why you're wanting to implement certain strategies or encourage certain types of oral intake in terms of modified diets. So you've got kind of additional hurdles to mm-hmm. kind of deal with that I'm not saying doesn't happen in other caseloads. Absolutely they do. I'm just keeping the focus on our brain injury caseload tonight. Yes. But it's not that cut and dried, okay, the facial nerve is involved, that's leading to that person needing to be on a certain IDSI level of diet. It might be that actually there's also difficulties attending to what they're doing, mm-hmm. Or they might be impulsive as well.
Lack of insight into yeah. difficulties.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, you know, you think about, I guess I tend to think about these behavioural cognitive difficulties mainly in the sort of pre-oral stage. You know, I think about the person's behaviour and, like you were saying, Helen, that ability to pay attention. They might be very distractible. But we were talking about someone that Helen's working with, and we're not going to discuss in great detail because, you know, that distraction can also impact on the oral stage as well. So, you know, I have seen people forgetting that they've got food in their mouth and being distracted and getting up from the table, or what's a classic is wanting to talk to you while they've got food in their mouth. And, you know, I'm always sort of like, wait till you swallow, wait till your mouth's mm-hmm. empty, then we'll talk. Mm-hmm. Because, our, you know, people can get very distracted mm-hmm. even in the pre-oral stage, even in the oral stage.
Yeah, I think that just reflecting on the time when I worked in stroke versus only brain injury caseloads, I would say, and I'm happy to be corrected if people have had different experiences, but someone who has had a stroke presentation, very rarely were you seeing the challenges around impulsivity, inhibition, inattention, the amount of verbal prompts that someone might need to either slow down or to take their next mouthful. Instead, it was around maybe modifying the diet or modifying how the food was presented, because they could maybe only manage a certain amount of food on the spoon because chewing too much was difficult for them, or you know, it was too fatiguing or anything like that. Whereas now I might recommend that someone uses a certain utensil because that's reducing the amount that they can have, because actually they can't retain the strategy that they should only take a small amount at a time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've explained that very well, but hopefully that makes sense. But I think for all that every brain injury has its own presentation, there's definitely some common themes, no matter whether we're talking about a traumatic brain injury, a hypoxia, an infective cause, a subarachnoid hemorrhage. You can see that mm-hmm. those changes, the cognitive aspects, having an impact.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about, the sort of different aspects of that and how it impacts. So, I mean, we've mentioned attention and that distractibility, and, you know, I guess I'm trying to think about some of my people, you know, that I, when I'm doing staff training, I'm always saying to staff, what we want is a person who's alert and relaxed and, you know, sitting at a table. But, you know, many of our people who have these difficulties can be, you know, unable to sit for a period of time. They're unsettled, they're you know, wandering around, they're not paying attention to any strategies that you might be giving them, they're not paying attention to food in their mouths and things. So that's some of the difficulties we see with attention.
And it's interesting, just thinking on that aspect before we kind of think about other kind of cognitive impacts, this is where it's helpful to know what was that person like beforehand. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking of someone that I've seen whose family said, oh yeah, he could be called for his dinner, and by the time the other family members have come and have put their salt and vinegar on their chips or whatever, he was finished. He was always a very quick eater. So then,
I wonder if we work with the same person.
So it's then that way where you think, is this impulsive behaviour, or how much of it?
And do you know what? I think when you look at that, you kind of have to go, all right, is the person safe? You know, was there any signs of difficulty? Because I'm always the same, Helen. I'm like, I'm not going to make a disability. If it's not broken, I'm not going to try and fix it. Mm-hmm. You know, because we were talking earlier, we work with a lot of males. Males do tend to take bigger bites, and they tend to be, and sorry, I'm probably being a little
very
non-PC.
We'll edit this out if it's too much, listeners.
Maybe a little bit messier. Sorry. At least in the people that I'm working with, you know. So I think, well, you know, let's have a look at, you know, the whole thing. Is a problem, you know?
Yeah.
Am I seeing anything? Like, are they actually managing to chew the food and create the bolus? Are they swallowing it? Are they clearing their mouth? Are there any signs of difficulty? You know, no? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, isn't it? Just there's so many people whose probably natural baseline nowadays, it's well known that people don't give enough time to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all rushing around. You know, you go to any supermarket car park Monday to Friday, as sometimes I do out in the community to grab my lunch.
Yeah.
And you're surrounded by blokes. Men in vans who are just quickly eating something
in between deliveries.
So this is something that I've just had a slight kind of be in my bonnet about recently, that we're all bringing our own values to our patients, and we just need to take a step back sometimes and think, okay, this person's eating really quickly. Is that because of the brain injury? Is it because they're starving? And they haven't, you know, they're not eating as regularly as they used to. You know, maybe the person was a grazer before and constantly ate.
Yeah.
Or is this actually something we need to do something about?
Now they've got restricted access to food just because of the environment, not because there's a problem. It's just that lunch is at this time, dinner's at that time, and you cannot eat in between.
Yeah.
Unless you've got a nice visitor bringing you food. But that brings to mind a couple of stories for me, Helen. I remember many years ago getting a call from one of our services because a man that I'd worked with, who had been on a pureed diet, but we managed to work up to a normal diet, and then he had a choking incident, and the call was whether the service should now thicken his fluids as a result of the choking incident. I was like, what? Sorry. So I went to the service and sort of talked to the staff about what had happened, and it turned out that this man had been late to rise that day, and missed his breakfast, so was only getting lunch, and so wolfed his first mouthful of his lunch and then ended up having an incident. So, you know, it's just little things like that, isn't it? Taking the whole picture. And so, you know, my recommendations were, if he misses breakfast, give him a snack, you know, give him something to eat when he rises so that he's not hungry and attacking lunch, you know, so.
And it feels almost like it should be redundant to even have to say this, but surely that's common sense.
Yes,
but clearly,
I have a slide in my training saying common sense.
Yeah, you know, because if that was any one of us listening to this, if you sleep in and, you know, you miss a time, like, you know, take me Monday to Friday, I'm up at 6:15, I have my breakfast at the same time. If I have a lie-in at the weekend and I wake up and I've slept an extra hour or two, oh, I'm actually much more hungry than I usually am.
Have a banana.
Have a bit of toast. You're not telling me that you can't access something for that person.
Yeah.
Because none of us would want to have to wait till lunch.
Yeah.
Or first meal of the day, if that's not what we usually do.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting if we ever get any intermittent fasters and things like that, you know, people who are habitually not eating for, you know, 12 hours a day or something like that. But we're being tangential, Jan, I think.
Yes, okay. other cognitive factors, impulsivity, so that's that lack of
lack of inhibition.
That's it. I often say the two negatives together, which means that it's opposite. Yes, anyway, yeah, so impulsivity. Well, we see, I do remember working with somebody who just, you know, had come in. I'm not sure how the acute hospital were managing, but he'd come in on a normal diet. He was a young, fit guy, you know. And the first time I saw him, he actually attempted to put the whole chicken breast into his mouth, you know. And I thought, okay, you know, this is he came in and he was quite, I guess, yes, he was in our challenging behavior unit, so, you know, he had significant needs in all areas. So I, of course, sort of said, look, I'm not suggesting that he needed a modified diet at that point, but he needed a modified presentation of his diet. Because, you know, at one point, you know, when a staff member attempted to, you know, slow him down in his eating, he actually physically assaulted that person. So I thought, right, well, let's try and present food in a way that it's more paced for him, you know, not putting the whole plate in front of him at that time, but just sort of, you know, trying to present him with smaller amounts and just keeping that going.
And
know?
That's it.
Avoiding the issue, but, yeah, you know.
That's definitely kind of been my experience, and I know what me and my kind of speech therapy colleagues will recommend as well. If there's that impulsivity, it's not always better to say, well, we need to downgrade the level of diet that person is on and they need a level 5 or a level 6 or something like that. It might just be, actually, can we present the food in a smaller amounts or have the food cut up first? So, or change, like I mentioned before, change the utensil, you know, and you're maybe, I know we have a supply of different kind of spoons, for example, but it's also about collaborating with your colleagues in occupational therapy. It's about collaborating with your psychology colleagues about, you know, if there's, like, the person you mentioned who was in your challenging behaviour unit, I'm assuming there were other issues and other behaviours that were cropping up. So psychology would absolutely have some insights in how best to kind of manage this around meal times, you know. So it's important that it's not just the speech therapist listening thinking, I've got to decide all of this myself. It's about collaborating. And
the other thing that I think is really important is that I do feel a lot of pressure for swallowing difficulties, and, you know, but I always come back to what you're just saying, Helen, that this is a team. This is, and the person and the family are in the team, and the medical practitioner as well, because, you know, swallowing impacts on a person's health. So I need the medical person involved talking to me and supporting me through all the decision making, you know. So that sort of gives me a bit more confidence in what I'm doing, you know.
Yeah, because it's that thing, we are, as I'm sure we said before, you know, we are the swallowing professionals, the experts in that, But I think when you come to the world of brain injury, there are so many factors at play that you can't be the one who's solely responsible for the decisions about how something is managed. You can certainly say, here's what I think about this person's swallow presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And can see, we will have greater insights on what's going on at the pre-oral stage and investigating kind of what might help.
Mm-hmm.
But that absolutely can be something done in conjunction with occupational therapy. So it's not just you. And I think the people that I think can really struggle perhaps with managing patients that are particularly impulsive, you are often seeing this at the kind of early stages, aren't you? I know it can persist, absolutely. But unfortunately, we're maybe thinking about patients that are maybe still within more of an acute setting with staff that are maybe not as confident or as
skilled
just not had as much experience in all of this. And I don't just mean speech therapists, I mean all healthcare workers on a ward. So it's,
well, particularly, I don't know what it's like in other parts of the world, but often our people with brain injuries, like, you know, they're on the mainstream wards. They're not specific brain injury wards.
No, exactly. So
stroke, other types of brain injuries, you'll often find them on respiratory or surgery or orthopaedics, you know.
And so then you have staff around them that often are, there's not enough staff
mm-hmm.
to potentially provide the one-to-one support that you or I might see within our workplaces that can provide that, okay, right, let's, the verbal prompts to slow down or to chew or to swallow or whatever else it might be. It's just sometimes practically not possible. And so that is where maybe a modified diet becomes the answer, because we still need to help someone maintain their nutritional needs.
Of course.
But in the absence of staff or potentially family members being able to support, to have someone go at a pace. And this applies as well for people who struggle to initiate. You know, they need the verbal prompts as well.
Yeah.
It goes both ways. So we do recognise that these sorts of things can be very difficult to do in a lot of settings.
Yeah.
But if we are thinking about a person who maybe does present with other behavioural difficulties,
mm-hmm.
in my experience, often these are individuals that if they're on a more of a kind of general ward somewhere, they're maybe getting kind of one-to-one supervision. And so there's maybe then scope for someone to help. Doesn't work every time, though. This is the thing. In case you haven't figured it out yet, doesn't work every time is the mantra of brain injury rehab, I think.
Yeah.
But you give it a go.
Yeah.
You work it out, you problem solve.
Yeah. And then thinking about executive functions and, you know, organisation and planning and, you know, I think that sort of covers a little bit to do with both the attention and the impulsivity, because you'll see that, won't you? You'll mm-hmm. you'll just see people being so disorganised and, you know, trying to do other things at the same time.
Yeah. And or the person I'm thinking of who, if you brought his pudding at the same time as the main, it all gets mixed together.
Yeah, just, yeah.
Custard and chips don't go, do you know, not in any world.
Yeah.
But it did for this person.
Yeah. I often use an example of somebody when I'm doing staff training of, he didn't have a care plan for swallowing dysphagia or whatever, because he didn't have that. He had executive functions difficulties, you know. He was the greatest guy in the unit. Everybody loved him. Funny guy. Really, all the other people in the unit, you know, he was, they all loved him. Staff and the other people with brain injuries all loved him. Until mealtime. And then nobody wanted to sit with them because the tablecloth and himself was cut, because it was just chaotic. There was just food everywhere. So what we did was we had a few people, and the person before who was, you know, hitting people over his food. He progressed, he became more paced. So what we did was we set up come dine with me.
Mm.
So what we did, we got our one of our smaller dining rooms, we set up like a restaurant. We had one of the male support workers working with them, and it was like a restaurant. And so we practiced, you know, what the behaviours that you would need, you know, sitting up straight, cutlery, trying to keep your plate clean, you know, mm-hmm. and they did that for a week, just practicing, you know.
And did that make a difference?
Yeah,
that's great. I love that.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean about problem solving. Like, and again, I can appreciate, you know, the settings that we're in. We would have the scope to be able to do that. If you're on a general surgical ward, it's not really probably going to, that's not going to work in exactly the same way. But you could take elements of that, you know, is there a scope to have that person come to a different setting, you know, in the wards, you know, or, is there a day room or something?
You're going to take them to the cafe down in the main reception of the hospital, you know, you could be coaching beforehand, sort mm-hmm. of saying, or priming, you know, these are the behaviours we're going to practice, and, you know, so. So just practicing, when I'm again doing staff training, I'm doing a lot of staff training at the moment, so it's kind of forefront in my mind. I talk about that I never use this in public places with the person that's got the needing the practice, but I use the concept of like table manners, because I think we've all heard it. We all know what that's, it sort of conjures up these, I say, you've either been a child or you have children. So I remember, you know, what do you think about if I was to say table manners? And so the staff will sort of list all the behaviours, and I'm saying, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's common sense. These are the things that we want to all, you know, when you see someone that's maybe having a little bit of, you know, difficulty in the meal, we don't want to just immediately write a care plan. Let's just try gently prompting with some of these general behaviours that can improve.
And that'll really work for the people that are impulsive, the people that overfill mm-hmm. their minds, the people that rush, that are disorganised, that are distractible. I'm thinking the people who struggle to initiate, the people that you put their meal down and come back half an hour later and it's not been touched, or it's, they've only had a little bit of it. I find that, again, you know, the one-on-one verbal prompts can be good. I've also found if you can get that person with other people and into an environment, like we have a kind of a ADL kitchen in our unit, that if we can have three or four people around sitting at the kitchen table
exactly.
together, so that person who maybe struggles to initiate, oh, can they actually pick up on the cues from other people
mm-hmm.
so that, again, it's not right, take your next mouthful,
yeah.
but instead they're picking up on those environmental cues.
Following the pattern and,
yeah. Does, again, it doesn't work every time, but it's just about thinking
outside
the box.
Stacking everything in your favour.
And, you know, and obviously you're giving the individual the choice, because, again, I've definitely had people where we've done that, right, let's come along to the kitchen, and some days they want to do that and some days they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you can start to build up a picture. Are they managing more on the days when they're with other people, or actually is it far too distracting to be around other people? So, yeah, it's just about seeing what's the pattern of behaviour, because the swallow function is an involuntary reflex.
It gets to the pharyngeal stage.
Yeah, but there's so much else going on that's actually down to behaviour, to environment, to social cues, you know. And we kind of touched on it before. We're just thinking about the people, about the men who like to eat quickly. But I'm also thinking, I think I maybe mentioned this in the last episode, but I've certainly had a few patients in recent months where something has cropped up that just really reminds you that when someone has a brain injury, that's just one aspect of who they are, and they bring their whole life journey with them. So I'm thinking of some people that maybe have some, whether diagnosable or not, but disordered eating patterns. People who've previously mm-hmm. had diagnosed eating disorders.
Yeah.
And that might have been something that was, you know, very well managed for a number of years prior to their injury, but then the injury happens, they're in a different environment, they're, you know, they're maybe having to be recorded, you know, there's a food record chart going,
mm-hmm.
suddenly they're getting weighed every week, you know, so sometimes things crop up that triggers people, and it wouldn't surprise me if we see that more and more in coming years, because mm-hmm. I'm just thinking there's a lot of focus on weight and how people look, and some people really don't want to eat certain types of mm-hmm. things, and or have food aversions and things like that, and it's
you're just talking about that triggered another thought, Helen, and we did a podcast in our first year with can't remember her name, about the nutritionist that
yes.
changes of taste and smell, was it
oh yes,
yeah, I don't know the name of it.
Oh,
don't
my god, Sharon,
yes,
from
yes.
Red Pepper Nutrition,
yes, because yes. it's so often
I had a delayed access there, listeners. I couldn't remember
well,
her name.
Well done, you, because I have got no idea. But, you know, that change to, was it sense of taste?
Mm-hmm. Taste and smell were both, are probably more common than we really think, but they have a huge impact on someone's appetite.
Yeah, I think, was she saying it was a change in sense of smell because of where the olfactory nerves mm-hmm. are, and that impacts on the sense of taste?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, if I remember right.
And so that impacts on people's eating and drinking and things as well.
And I don't know about where you are, Jan, but most of our listeners are probably familiar with NHS food. That can be variable in terms of how it looks. And we all know that we eat with our eyes, first of all, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You think that you're getting fish and chips, and then what comes out
doesn't look like that. A bit like a McDonald's burger.
Yeah.
You think you're getting that lovely, juicy-looking thing, and then you get this, not mm-hmm. quite.
Yeah, so
soggy lettuce. So there's lots of things that we need to consider. You know, a big issue, and I struggle with it, is, you know, people's ability, even if they lack capacity, to still make choices,
mm-hmm.
and how we work with that. I'd love to do a whole episode with someone who could talk with us about that, because, you know, for me, I'm always, well, you know, even if a person lacks capacity, even if they've got a legal framework around them, I'm not aware of any service, any law in the world that would say, well, we force feed people or we allow them to starve. So what do we do when a person says, no, I'm not going to follow those recommendations, you know?
Yeah, I think so. No matter what area of speech and language therapy you're working in, if you see anyone with an eating, drinking or swallowing difficulty, you're going to see people that have difficulties that maybe you can't manage, but that individual still wants to be able to have things. And I think it's an ongoing, challenging area.
And I know that the RCSLT has the eating and drinking with acknowledged risks framework, which is, you know, a guideline, which is sort of really helpful for us to sort of consider and help us work through the process, you know. But I have done a couple of small things in time, but, you know, working in quite a sort of medical legal sort of environment, for me, you know, I feel like that sort of takes over, and it's like, this is what you're having, you know.
Yeah.
you will do as we say, you know. So
yeah, and so I think, like, it's worth highlighting that if we, as speech and language therapists, recommend someone has certain diet and fluids, if the person is willing to go to accept those recommendations, or there is some sort of framework in place, like here in Scotland we have the Adults with Incapacity Act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Act. I was just like, am I saying the right word there? I think in England and Wales it's different legislation. You know, but in that person's kind of best interests, we're saying, you know, for this time period, we think modifying diet and fluids is going to be the best thing. To
putting someone under observations when eating, you know, that's restricting their...
Just something, but we're hoping, particularly at that kind of early, you know, an earlier stage or initially when we're seeing them, that there's the scope for things to get better,
uh-huh.
both in terms of their swallow function or the behaviours that are presenting.
Their independence.
But also... that there might come a point where that AWI can be lifted and that they are deemed to have capacity to make decisions about themselves. And I think we should also mention just about incapacity, because I can hear the psychologists and the psychiatrists out there saying, capacity for what? We are talking very specifically about eating and drinking here, and eating and drinking at acknowledged risk.
But even if, you know, but Carolyn, I mean, as I say, I'd love a whole episode on this if anyone's interested.
Yeah.
Even if a person's deemed to lack capacity, if they refuse to eat, like, people can refuse treatment.
You know?
We have people that have COPD who still smoke.
Yeah.
You know, so
this is the thing, we all do things that are not really the best thing for us. Mm-hmm. I eat too much chocolate and my waistline's expanding.
Yeah.
I know I need to do something about that.
Yeah.
Haven't quite got on board with that just yet.
I hope you have the capacity to make that decision,
well,
Helen.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Who's going to assess that?
Yeah. So we all do things that we know we shouldn't, and we don't want to lose sight that this patient is an individual in front of us.
Whether they have capacity or not, they're... Mm-hmm. Let's start with the person, you know. So I do struggle quite a bit with it. I'm not going to say that I don't.
No, and I think it's right to struggle with it, because it's a fundamental human right to eat and drink and have access to nutrition. And we are making potentially big decisions about something that's so fundamental to us. The kind of RCSLT guidelines that are available if you're a member, I think you have to be a member to be able to access it. It's a nice 23-page document that really kind of runs through the multidisciplinary approach to eating and drinking at acknowledged risk. And there's a nice kind of flow chart in there that does break down from a particular for speech and language therapist, you're thinking, okay, is this a dysphagia that's likely to improve? So okay, let's treat that and hope for improvement. If there isn't improvement, or if we can't treat it, that's where that MDT assessment's kicking in. Let's look at capacity, let's look at what we know and has been documented about that individual's decisions or what previous, you know, wishes have they been able to kind of get across. What does the family think? Or the kind of legal guardian? Is there power of attorney in place?
Mm-hmm.
Guardianship, all of these things. And that's before we're even thinking about, do we have to think about alternative forms of nutrition, hydration? Is that appropriate? And like you're saying, Jan, there's not anything to say that person's going to starve.
Mm-hmm.
So if that person is not appropriate for a PEG, for an NG, for...
And what is that word appropriate, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean? Like, is it if the person says, I don't want that, does that mean that they are not appropriate for a PEG? Mm-hmm. I would say yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So...
So it's then about going, okay, that's where you're at, and that's where our MDT has come to. We think that there's some risks with you continuing to eat and drink. Let's document that. We've discussed all of this.
What can we do around it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I often think I did adult support and protection training for Talking Mats many years ago, And they had a visual of, you know, someone walking across a river on a tightrope with crocodiles underneath. And so what they said, you know, when you're supporting someone who lacks capacity around, you know, for a risk area, it's about building that bridge around that risk. So, okay, this person's refusing what we deem as less risky food or fluids, but they're refusing that. Okay, so what strategies or what supports can we put around their choice to minimize the risk? Because I think you're never going to eliminate risk.
No. So, and it's about communicating that well. I think I can think of so many occasions, again, not necessarily related to brain injury, but it must happen. I can think of a couple of times where there's been that decision making process, but then, for example, there's a change in the care package that someone gets, or someone for maybe another reason gets admitted to hospital, and then everything kind of comes up again.
Yeah.
This person's having a normal diet, but they're really
risky.
And then you have to go back and say, well, actually, yeah, all of this has been discussed and documented.
Yeah. And also, to, you know, I often, going to finish on staff training in a moment, but I often have to provide staff training to people that are working, like support workers working in the community on their own and houses and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're living with these, you know, supporting people with these decisions and things. And I, you know, the documentation is to support those staff, you know, we're here to obviously do the very best we can to keep the person with the brain injury safe and well. As a speech and language therapist, I'm also here for the staff, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want any staff member, experiencing anything negative and worrying about it and feeling uncomfortable or not feeling like they've got the support required. So that's where that documentation comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other just interesting bit, the kind of flowchart that's in this document from RCSLT, at the bottom, it mentions end of life care and future care planning. So I think future care planning is kind of what you're talking about there.
Yeah.
I'm thinking when I see end of life care, I'm thinking more back to my time working in care of the elderly, dementia, population, palliative. Because we have probably both, Jan, had people who have been eating, drinking things that we think, oh, I really wouldn't be what I would recommend, but we've gone through this whole process, and you know, there you see them several years later and they're, you know,
still going
you know.
I remember many years ago,
might be because of the wonderful support around them, but also, you know, we sometimes are making recommendations based on the worst outcome possible, so we are worrying about choking and about aspiration, but maybe actually, you know, those things are mitigated by other
strategies,
environment.
And that's where you have to be creative and work with the person.
Yeah.
Just a very quick story and then we'll finish on the, what was it, the
staff
competency
training
framework. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is not brain injury. This was my previous role in the community in Australia with children with disabilities. So, you know, I had a situation where a headmaster, a head principal, as they call them in Australia, wouldn't admit a child into the school because the family were refusing to give the child thickened fluids. And the school felt that, you know, the child that had been assessed by a speech and language therapist, video fluoroscopy and all the rest, to be safer on thickened fluids. So, you know, I just, that situation for me, it was just when the safe water protocol or whatever had come out. So, negotiated, I would call it, with the family in the school that when the child was in school, they would have thin water. And then, you know, If the family wanted to give the child whatever they wanted outside school, if it was, you know, cordial, you know, they were taking capacity, they were making those decisions. So it was like we didn't use those terms, best interests and, you know, all of that. You know, there was just a care plan written and agreed upon. But, you know, it's like you, Helen, you know, many years later, that child was thriving, mm-hmm. and, you know, he had a profound disability, he had cerebral palsy, an intellectual disability, you know, he was fully dependent on everybody for all his activities of daily living, yet, you know, years later, drinking thin fluids, mm-hmm. and thriving, so...
Yeah, which... ties neatly into the thickened fluid position paper, you know, because it is that individualized plan that we need to make for people. But yeah,
it's not. And in saying that, we all know that there's always the exception to the rule, and mm-hmm. you know what that if that had happened with somebody else, then maybe the child had got sick. So you know, it's not that it works for everybody, but you know, let's. Go try and listen to the person and the family and, mm-hmm. you know, look.
I think it's not an area that you can be black and white about. You have to be able to be holistic. And that's such a great example of going... I think once upon a time, there would have definitely been people saying, well, no, they're on that child's on thickened fluids and that is absolutely what they have to have. We're not moving from that position. Mm-hmm. But... in the long run, it's worked out so much better to reach an agreement mm-hmm. that works, that allows that child to access the school that they should absolutely be accessing. Okay, I'm not going to lie, I think it's a shame that the school were kind of refusing to accommodate the recommendations that were being made, but you've all kind of worked together to come to a reasonable point. Yeah. And that's what we have to try and do, rather than being digging your heels in and saying, have to come and meet me where I am.
Okay, so...
Competencies.
Yeah, competencies. So, I mean, this is another big piece of work that the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapists have recently released for us, which is fantastic. And... I can't, you know, I think it's eating and drinking and swallowing competency framework, but mm-hmm. I'm sure if you Google it, if you want, we could attach a link or something, you know, I'm sure everybody that's listening knows about it, mm-hmm. but it's really, really been helpful. It sort of starts at public awareness level one, and works all the way up to even, you know, like, expert level, so it's really nice to see the progress. I wouldn't like to mark myself off against the framework because I'd be like, oh my god, too much pressure. But we certainly now, as a mandatory thing within our organisation, provide what I call level two mandatory training for eating, drinking, and swallowing. So. You know, it's not everything. You know, I kind of say to staff, it's knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's not really the application of this knowledge. The application of this knowledge is what builds your experience and your skills and your competence. So just because you've been and sat and listened to me for a few hours doesn't mean, oh, yeah, I've got it all, you know. So,
and I think it's nice to have the framework because I think it's consistently... an area that people can be quite frightened about if we are saying, right, this is what this person needs to be supported in. I will 9 times out of 10 say, I'm just really worried that they're going to choke. I'm worried that they're going to aspirate. Uh-huh. So if we can do what we can to help our staff.
Demystify it a little bit, maybe.
And help people feel more confident, then... that hopefully empowers people to feel mm-hmm. Feel better about implementing strategies that we are suggesting. Because, you know, I might go and see a patient and I'm there for half an hour, 45 minutes.
Exactly.
And then there's a healthcare support worker coming in to help them with breakfast, lunch and dinner 5 days a week, you know, and I've seen them for a fraction of the time, because it's not me who's there at 6 o'clock on a Saturday night when dinner comes round. So we have to have people feeling comfortable that they can do the job that we are asking them to do, but equally if they do feel a bit out of their depth, that they feel happy enough to come back to us or to nursing colleagues or to whoever to say, actually, this isn't, I'm not feeling comfortable with this, or I did these things that you suggested, but it wasn't, it didn't go that well when the last time I shadowed you doing something, just so that you can kind of keep that open conversation going, that will help that staff member feel better about their job and hopefully sees the patient benefit from it as well. So, you know, it's a win-win that way, isn't it, for that time investment at our end.
Yeah, and I do like the training, doing the training, because you get to develop a bit of a relationship with staff, you know, you get to hear their perspectives, you get to talk about some of the difficult issues. And I do say to staff that when they come to sit with me for a training session, you know, that like you're saying, Helen, you know, our competency is our responsibility, and if, you know, and likewise for our staff, that if they're not sure about something, to ask, you know, and then also that if we had someone with a more complex dysphagia, or, you know, that one-to-one training would be provided on a needs basis, you know. So this isn't the final story in this chapter. There's more to come, but you know, you need, I'm here whenever I'm here, and access me.
Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it? It's just about people feeling, because I do think people feel scared about someone having eating and drinking difficulties. And
oh, it's so pervasive, you know. I mean, eating and drinking, we do all the, how many times, somebody told me that we swallow about 900 times a day or something. I thought it was a bit less than that. We're swallowing at night, when we're swallowing our saliva at night, you know. And I always say to staff, when you go and hang out with your family and your friends, what are you doing usually? It usually always involves, I came here tonight, what did you do here?
Yeah, we had a cup of tea.
We had a cup of tea, yeah. So, I mean, it's such a big part of our life. And then the speech and language therapist comes along and says, oh, you now have to have level 2 fluids and level 5 food. You know, great, thanks, you've limited my choices, you know. So.
And it's that way where staff get so worried. And it's interesting, you know, if you have someone on your ward or your unit who's, for example, falls risk, I think most staff feel fairly comfortable in how to manage that. And I'm not saying, please don't think that I'm being blasé about it, you know, obviously, but there's a very clear cut process to follow around managing that and about what to do if there's a fall. But it just sometimes feel that when it comes to eating and drinking and swallowing, there's just that fear to even allow ourselves to get to that point where, you know, something might not go that well, but the odds of that worst case scenario happening, okay, we've got to have that in the back of our mind. But particularly people we are talking about, the worst that might happen is there might be some coughing, there might be some food that goes all over the place, and it needs a bit of clearing up. But there's going to be ways that staff can help that individual. So yeah, I think that's kind of my thing that I would really like listeners to think about, is just that, kind of, how can we help the day-to-day staff that are there on the ground all the time feel empowered to support our patients, so that then that has a knock-on positive impact on how the patients are managing. And that's rehab as well, you know, that time. We could get into a whole other thing about that whole 24/7 rehab, but I'm not going to go there. That's something for another time.
Anyone wants to come on and talk about their training program, love to hear about it, you know. Anyway, we should end here.
Yeah, we've chatted way more than I think we either of us particularly planned, but that's always the way.
Or thought we would be able to. We're like, oh gosh, having to do this without a guest.
What will we
talk about?
we can always fill, that's nearly an hour that we've been chatting away. So time flies. This is why it's nice doing the podcast with Jan, because she and I always think, well, we have enough to chat about, and then here we are.
Whether what we've chatted about is of any interest or help or whatever, but it's just the experiences of Helen and I in our day-to-day work.
So do get in touch through all the usual channels, Instagram, and I always say I need to get better at the Instagram, I will do that, and Twitter or X.
So what do we say now? We're Xing.
I don't know. I'm still just calling it Twitter.
All right. I heard someone call it X and they said I did a tweet on X. I'm like, okay.
So yeah, share your experiences, your stories, your advice, and if you would like to join us to talk about anything brain injury related, swallowing or otherwise, then we would love to hear from you. But yes, until next time, we'll say cheerio.
Okay, good night.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.